basically a mathematical concept. Okay, so I'm starting with an idea which you're all incredibly familiar with, so I don't need to go through it too much, but typical Schrödinger's cat, we have a cat in a box, and it's in a superposition state of being alive and dead. The somewhat paradoxical statement is that we never see cats in superpositions, and so we can't observe or measure this quantum system and see this superposition state. So one kind of cheat to get around this is to, rather than measure our quantum cat directly, is to say, okay, well, I'll consider this system and send a probe through it. So in this case, I send a little mouse through one side of the box and wait for it to come out the other side, and then I say I'll measure the mouse on the other side of the box. The idea is, because these quantum systems will interact in some way, I can use my probe to get some kind of gauge of what the system is doing. And in particular, I should measure the mouse and see some kind of trace of the cat left on it. So you can see, in this case, because it's cat and mice, say the mouse comes out completely scratched and it's missing half its tail or something like this, then you can say, well, if the mouse comes out harmed, the cat's alive. If the mouse comes out completely fine, then the cat's probably dead. This is an ideal thought experiment. So let's assume it's a normal cat, a normal mouse, and they don't like each other and stuff like this. This is just the idea, but the point is that we have interactions between these two quantum systems. And so the quantum non-demolition measurement, which was the title of my talk, is one particular type of measurement we can perform on this probe. So I'll go through that a bit more, but just keep this in mind. This is basically the experimental setup, which I'm going to explain later. So if it makes no sense, just remember cat and mice. Okay, so non-demolition measurement was originally proposed by Brzezinski, a Russian physicist, in 1974-ish, or 1970s, let's go with that. And then it was developed through the 80s by people like Kip Thorne got into it, and a bunch of people got into it, but the idea and the motivation behind it was they wanted to be able to perform incredibly precise quantum measurements. And they actually originally developed this idea so that they could detect gravitational waves. So it's kind of a nice like moment to be going back to it. So just some kind of brief ideas about non-demolition measurement. It's described as one of the most classical, and I say this like quote unquote, measurement that you can perform on a quantum system, not because it doesn't act like normal measurement, like collapsing the wave function or whatever, but because it kind of preserves the quantum integrity of a system. So it has the less least disturbance on a quantum system out of a lot of measurements that you can perform. It's also often described as beating or like avoiding the standard quantum limit in precision, which you get typically from the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Again, this is kind of cheating the system a little bit. So back to our probe system model. One way to kind of get around the uncertainty principle is to say, okay, say I have my, this is like a resonator or something, and I can measure the energy quite well, then we know that there'll be some limit with which I can measure the phase. So instead of measuring the phase, what I can do is use my probe to interact with the system and measure something on the probe which tells me indirectly about the phase of the system itself. So this is an indirect measurement idea, but in terms of beating it, it's more cheating the system a little bit because you don't really measure phase, but you gain information about phase. So the kind of big win for quantum non-demolition measurements, or QND observables, which you measure, is that they don't have this property of back action, which a lot of quantum measurements do. So whenever we have a quantum measurement, then it induces noise on the system in some way. And so it obstructs the precision of future measurements that we can do. So QND measurements kind of avoid that completely, which is really neat. Like I said, they want to perform really precise measurements. In particular, they want to perform a time sequence of measurements of one observable over and over and over again. And so one of the kind of main mathematical things that you need your observable to satisfy is that the observable at some time t commutes with itself at some other time s, which is kind of okay. So I'll just give you like the nicest example of this is a free particle just moving along. And say its energy and momentum are conserved. So if I want to know what the energy or momentum of that particle is at any time, I'll get the same result. And so like kind of trivially, it satisfies this commutation relation. Position, however, is not a QND observable. And you can see this quite nicely by saying, if I consider the position of the particle at time t, and then what's its time, its position at some later time, x of t plus tau, then basically I can say that's x plus vt. But you can write it in terms of the momentum. And so then when I look at this commutation relation between the position, the initial position and the later position, you can see that it doesn't commute. So it obviously doesn't satisfy this. This kind of, I guess, highlights the idea of these back actions, because the back action is kind of induced from being able to write, one operator in terms of something that it doesn't commute with. And so if I measure momentum precisely, then it has ramifications for the precision with which I can measure position. So yeah, so we're concerned with things that obey this. You can see a similar example, it's a bit more detailed for like things like harmonic oscillators in this book. If anyone's interested, I'd really recommend this book by Brzezinski and others, Quantum Measurement. Yeah, he's like the godfather, so that book's really neat. Okay, so yeah, now that we've seen an example, we want to go back to our system probe model, because that's kind of what we care about for this experiment. And we want to know if we have our probe in some initial state, then what can I say about the observable which I want to measure? And so it turns out, I'm not going to derive anything, I'm just kind of giving the punchlines. You want the observable to commute with the evolution operator, and that's the evolution operator for the combined system. So it's probe plus system plus some interaction term. I want to write on the blackboard, but I don't know how to turn the lights on. Does anyone know how to turn the lights on? Oh, the button that says lights? Okay, so we have this Q, U, oh no, I've chosen the wrong spot, equals zero. So if we look just at this bit, if this is true, then I can multiply through by a U dagger and it doesn't change the right-hand side, but we get the relationship that we want this. So U dagger Q times U minus Q acting on psi to be zero. And so what I can say is if I have any arbitrary initial state of my probe, then basically I want this condition to be satisfied by my observable. And what this is quite strong because you're saying something about the evolution of the observable, right? So this is the evolved, if this is some initial time, this is that operator at some later time, because we've evolved the operator. So that means then that we can look at the time evolution of this operator explicitly. If I press this button, will it work? Okay, so now we're concerning just with the operator for any general probe. Oh no. Can you bring it back, please? God.
I'll drop it down in a second.
Thank you. Oh, okay. Basically, what we can do is look at the evolution of this operator in the Heisenberg picture. And if this is zero, then I'll just write it and see if I can race the machine. Then you get something like this. I can never remember whether it's plus or minus. Then this just says that it satisfies this relationship. So this is a little bit stronger than this, because we're saying something more explicit. In particular, what you can notice is if our observable Q has no time dependence, then this term's zero automatically. And they say if it's an integral of motion of each of the independent systems, then this is true. And it will commute with this Hamiltonian is H of the probe plus H of the system plus H of the interaction. And so if this term's zero, then we want this to commute. And then if it's an integral of motion of both of the individual systems, then basically it commutes with these two automatically. And then we have some condition on our observable with our interaction. And these are things that we can control a bit more precisely experimentally. Okay. Yeah. So those are kind of the mathematical constraints you have on your observable. But I kind of feel like a lot of the time we get to that point and go, great, experimentalist. So it's quite hard to make the connection. I'm not an experimentalist, so I can't make it totally explicit. But what I'll do is give you an example of a particular experiment which implemented these QND observables. So it was awarded the 2012 Nobel Prize, for anyone who keeps track of these things. Went to a French experimentalist group led by Haroche, and I think US led by Wineland. And they were awarded the Nobel Prize for measuring and manipulating a single quantum system. I'm going to go through the French experiment, which was a kind of the first realization of cavity QED. And so now that's kind of laid the groundwork for a whole new field in terms of quantum information and quantum communication and things like that. So,
quick question. Your observable Q.
Yeah.
Is that acting on the Hilbert space of the cat or the mouse?
The mouse. Yeah, so this Q, this observable is for the mouse. Okay. The U, though, is the total thing. So the two experiments were done basically at the same time, but using the reverse experimental setup, and they used similar techniques and kind of got similar results as well. So the French people had a cavity with light, a light field in between two mirrors, and they probed it with atoms by sending atoms through and then measured the atoms. The US guys had the reverse, basically. They had atoms trapped, and then they probed them with electromagnetic field. And so what the French guys were able to observe. So I'm going to go through the measuring bit. The manipulation was a bit too technical for me. So basically, they were able to observe and measure quantum jumps in a state of light, or these jumps in the state of this electromagnetic field in their cavity. So this is their experimental setup. I want the hockey stick. Okay, first thing is this cavity. This is the light field, this little blue tubey thing. Again, I'm not entirely sure how, but they were able to basically have a light cavity inside this field, which is in a superposition state of having no photon and one photon. So that's our cat state inside the field, one or no photons, or vacuum and one photon. And then they sent atoms along this path here, shown in blue. They came out of this big box called O, and then we detected them at D, or they detected them at D. So the type of atom they use is called a Rydberg atom. It's kind of schematically shown here in pink. The idea is you have your nucleus in the center, and the outermost electron in this atom is in like such a wide circular orbit around it that you can neglect the nucleus, basically. And so then what you have is an electron in a circular orbit, and you can consider the wave function as basically looking like this, some wave based on that circle. So again, they used a two-level atom. So the ground state for this atom was something like 50 wavelengths inside the circumference of this circle, and the excited state was like 51 wavelengths or something like this. So minor details, but the point is that, say I start with some atom, they send it through this sort of mini cavity and give it a pulse with microwave lasers or something. And when it comes out the other side, that pulse puts it into a superposition of the ground and excited state. And so you can see this schematically because it's got kind of constructive and destructive interference around that circle. So now we have our probe in a superposition state and our cavity in a superposition state. If I send this atom through, it's going to interact with the light field in some way. In particular, the importance of their experiment was that the light field didn't resonate with the transition between the ground and excited state of the atom. If it did, then you would just have jumps in the atom's state, right? If it's in ground and it hits a photon, it'll go up to the excited state. Rather, this, because it didn't quite match, the interaction basically wrote a phase onto the superposition of the atom. So you can kind of see that again schematically. I don't know if you can actually see it with the light, but once it goes through, basically you have some change in the structure of this superposition state. Okay, so it's got some marking on it from this light field. And then it comes through and they apply another pulse to it, which basically kills, it kind of undoes this step, I guess. And then we detect it. So the detection of this atom, we will only see it in the ground or excited state, but because it's had this phase written into it, like a relative phase between the two, we can basically, and whatever magic they do with this, you can basically pick up some indication of that. And that allows you to measure the atom and see indirectly the state of the photon in the cavity.
So you have an atom, and you impose a 51 before entering. You have a ground state and you make a superposition, mm-hmm. and then you enter the cavity.
Mm-hmm.
And then you somehow impose.
You do that. I'm kind of sketchy on the details because it was quite technical and I don't
You undo that and then you see what happens. So did they mention why they want to put the and then undo this?
So I guess the way, you mean why they wanted to send a superposition in? Or
the R1 and the R2 be there? Why don't they just send
a... Well, so the R1 creates your superposition.
Yeah, and the R2 removes the superposition.
R2 kind of removes it.
I'll just send the state in, if it come out excited, and if there is one photon, if it didn't, then there is zero photon.
So I... What did you say?
It's easier to measure phase differences with this R2 operation.
Yeah. I think also as well with the interaction they had, it kind of, yeah, like you said, it's easier to see the trace of it when you have a superposition. Oh, no. Okay. I am sketchy on the experimental details. So obviously, basically, the interaction that you have between this photon in the cavity and the atom is going to depend on whether there's an actual photon at the time in the cavity. And so what they were able to do is make a correlation between whether they detected the atom in its ground state, then they knew that would mean that there was no photon in the cavity at the time, and then if they detect the atom in its excited state, then that means that it did interact with this atom. And basically that came down to a choice in the phase that this interaction wrote onto it. And so the kind of QND-ness of it is that we want to continuously observe this, right? Or at least at time intervals. So there's some differences between whether you do a QND observation at discrete times or continuous times, but more or less this kind of structure is the same. Yeah?
So what are we actually measuring at D? Like the number of...
D, we're measuring the state of the atom.
Yeah, so how do you measure a state of death?
I have no idea.
No idea.
I'm sorry. No. I would point to that paper.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I kind of tried to pull out the key bits,
mm.
but yeah, I understand that I'm being sketchy on experimental details. And when, yeah, it's the kind of thing like when you come up with some thing that you want to measure and then you go over to the experimentalist and say, I need this observable. And then suddenly a few months later it's there. I'm sorry, I don't know. Okay, so this is the results. So like I said, they were able to correlate the ground state of the atom with the light field being in the vacuum state and the excited state of the atom, it being in the photon state, having a photon there. And so every line on this plot in the top half, red and blue, corresponds to a single detection of an atom. So you can see for the initial period, they more or less only detected atoms in the ground state. And then at some time, suddenly they started detecting atoms in the excited state, and that lasted some length, and then it dropped back down and they only detected atoms in the ground state. So they had quite a nice phrase to say that they were able to observe the birth, life, and death of a photon. Yeah, so this kind of shows the state of the photon in the cavity. So there's no photon, suddenly there's a photon, and then it disappears. So yeah, like I said, this was kind of the groundbreaking experiment in terms of cavity QED, because not only were they able to observe this distinct jump in the state of the photon, they were then able to go and manipulate that state in ways which I'm unable to describe because I'm, yeah, not so apt in that area. But they were able to control it and manipulate it to have particular properties that they want or things like that. And so now this field is kind of going into the area where it's used an incredibly large amount in quantum information and quantum communication. Basically, because these systems were two-state systems, it's quite good in terms of qubit manipulation. And if you can control and manipulate them, then maybe it's useful in quantum computational kind of situations. Yeah, I think that's all I wanted to say about that. Okay, so I hope that kind of gave some idea, at least, even without the messy details of how you can then go and do these things. I don't know the exact quantum measurements they used in the recent gravitational wave things. I know it did rely quite a bit on quantum optics, basically, which is very strongly connected with these cavity QEDs ideas. Yeah, so what I wanted you to get out of this is that this system probe model for quantum measurement is one of the nicest ways that we can actually implement quantum measurement and find out things about a quantum system without directly measuring it. In particular, it's useful in things, yeah, like I said, like quantum information. You can then use it and control quantum systems, which lets you get around one of the biggest problems, I guess, that originally arose in quantum measurement and the measurement problem and stuff like that. I went through at least schematically the ideas in quantum non-demolition measurement and the fact that you want to be able to perform a time sequence of incredibly precise measurements on a quantum system. Yeah, and the conditions that it had on its, on those observables. And then I at least gave you, again, a schematic idea of the Hirosh experiment, which is really cool. And the paper's actually really neat and very easy to read, even though some of the experimental details are a bit gory. So, yeah, thank you.
Clarify what you wrote up on the board for me. It seems as though you want your observable not, you want the expectation value of your observable not to change in time.
Yeah, I guess in a way, I think then it would trivially satisfy this Q of S, this commutation relation, right? So what you want is the commutation relation to be zero. You can relate that to this. That's only if you're considering an observable which is constant in time and commutes with the probe system and the, yeah, the probe Hamiltonian and the system Hamiltonian. Yes. If you would like to know how on earth that is the case, I would recommend this book by Brudzinski, because I'm in no way an expert on it. There's a chapter in there called Non-Demolition Measurement. Yeah, sorry. Their equivalents, it's kind of, there are differences between whether it's a sufficient condition or a necessary and sufficient condition for this to be true. I think being zero is the ideal case, right? I mean, obviously, experimentally, you can never make something perfect.
Because your observables are interacting with the system you want to probe.
It's not saying that it's not interacting. Is that what you said? It's not interacting with the system?
If you put the mouse in and you're measuring something like the contents of the mouse's stomach, not really if it's been scratched or not.
No, but I wouldn't measure the contents of the mouse's stomach.
But
if I wanted to know about the cat,
the outside of the mouse, like what your example of scratching or not, such a measurement would not commute with the interaction Hamiltonian between the mouse and the cat.
I feel like this is. I'm happy to talk to you about it afterwards, but I feel like this is kind of pushing the realms of thought experiment versus real experiment. So, yeah.
Okay. Let's thank Hara once again.
Thank you, Dennis. Hello, everybody. I'm going to talk about multiscale entanglement renormalization answers and holography. So this is the plan of my talk. First, I will introduce the entanglement and entanglement entropy. Then I will go to tensor network, and especially I will focus on MERA. MERA stands for multiscale entanglement renormalization answers, and also its counterpart called CMERA. Then I will give you an explicit example, CMERA for Klein-Gordon field, and finally I will discuss about holography and I will conclude. Let's start with entanglement. So if we have two subsystems A and B, we can just add them together and we will get a larger system, AB. And from our course on quantum theory, we know that if we, the Hilbert space for the big system, that is the tensor product of the Hilbert space of the individual subsystems. And if we take a state in the big system, sometimes it can be written as the tensor products. But it is not always the case. So if we can write psi AB as the tensor product of psi A and psi B, then that is called a factorized state. Otherwise, that is entangled. So the next question is, how can we measure the entanglement of the between the states? So the answer of this question is to measure the entanglement entropy, and that is defined as the von Neumann entropy for the reduced density matrix. So we all know what is density matrix, reduced density matrix. I'm not going to repeat it here. And in this table, I have written two states. In the left column, the state psi AB, that is the tensor product of zero in two subsystems, that is clearly not entangled. So now, if we compute the density matrix, reduced density matrix, and plug it in the entanglement entropy formula, we'll find that entanglement entropy is zero. So that clearly indicates that there is no entanglement. On the other hand, the right-hand side state, that is one of the four Bell states, and that is maximally entangled. Now we'll talk about why this is called maximally entangled. Now, if we follow again the procedure, we find the density matrix, reduced density matrix, and compute the entanglement entropy, we will find that the entanglement entropy is logarithm of 2. So in fact, if we have a two-dimensional Hilbert space, that is the maximum possible entanglement entropy we can have. And if we have a d-dimensional Hilbert space, then the maximum entanglement entropy is logarithm of d. And for this case, this is saturated. That's why this is called maximal entangled state. Now I am going to extend it. Suppose we have a spin chain, and it has it has lattices, and each lattice can contain a spin half particle. And to compute the entanglement entropy, let us divide the systems into two subsystems, A and B. And also let us assume that A has a length L, and it contains n spins. And most of the times we are interested in the ground state, but we don't have much information about the ground state. So we can assume the ground state is fully random. Then for a fully random random density matrix, the entanglement entropy is logarithm of D. And this is the dimension of the Hilbert space. And as this is a spin-half particle, D is 2 to the power n. If we substitute this D into the entanglement entropy formula, we get the punchline of this slide, and that is entanglement entropy scales with the size of the subsystem. Now I'm going to the tensor network. And the bad news is that Hilbert space is a big place, and it scales exponentially with the number of lattices. But we are lucky that we don't have to deal about all the Hilbert spaces, but we just need only one corner of it, and that is the ground state. And in the third line, I have written a generic state that can be written as the coefficient times the basis. But as we are interested in the ground state, we can do some optimization process. And this optimization is done by tensor networks. And three of the tensor networks are matrix product state, tree tensor network, and MERA. This is the first example of matrix product tensor network, that is matrix product space state, that is also called DMRG. It stands for density matrix renormalization group. So what is the idea? The idea is that this coefficient, this is a tensor, and this is a big tensor. It can be constructed from small tensors. And in the figure, this tripod, it is that small tensor, and it has three indices, alpha, beta, and sigma. This alpha, beta are the dummy indices, and you can tune it for the purpose of your computation. But this sigma, this is a physical variable. And matrix product state says that, okay, we have to contract all the indices, alpha and beta, and then we will get the coefficient. So in the matrix language, this is same as multiplying n number of matrices, m, and then taking trace of it. Now, this is another example of a tensor network, that is tree tensor network. So you can just see why this is called tree, because we are just taking two lattices, then we are merging them together to get the next stage, then we are doing the same procedure. So this is like the renormalization procedure that we have seen in our course of statistical mechanics. To see that whether this is really useful or not, we have to compute the entanglement entropy. So to compute the entanglement entropy, we can divide the system A and complementary of A, and the entanglement is coming from where the bond is forming. So now we can just think about a curve, and that is cutting this bond here and here. And as I have said in my previous slide, that alpha beta can run from 1 to j. So the maximum entanglement entropy can be logarithm of j, and there are two curves. One is here, another is here. That's why there is a factor of 2. The same story also goes for the tree tensor network. So this bond is cutting, this curve is cutting the bond. One is here, another is here. So that's why entanglement entropy is always less than or equal to 2 logarithm of j. So clearly there is a problem. Because in my previous slide, I have shown that the entanglement entropy that scales with the size of the system. But for these cases, the entanglement entropy is constant. So we need something else. And this something else is multiscale renormalization, entanglement renormalization ansatz, or MERA. So this is also like the tree tensor network. But there is an extra feature. And that extra feature it is this tetrapod. This is called the disentangler. So what is its purpose? So okay, before going to the coarse graining procedure, we just apply this disentangler that will disentangle that will disentangle some states, and then you do the coarse graining procedure. Then we add them together. And here I want to mention that we are always dealing with the same Hilbert space. And when we are doing this coarse graining procedure, we are losing some state. To get rid of this or to compensate this, we are adding extra zero state. So how this is solving the problem of entanglement entropy that we found before? The recipe is that we have to find a curve that has the boundary A. And you can say that, okay, there might be infinite number of curves. But it is said that we have to find a curve that is cutting the bond in a minimum number. And if we find that, if we find that curve, then it can be showed that the entanglement entropy is proportional to logarithm of L. And L is the number of sites in this region A. Again, we have to substitute, and then we will find that the entanglement entropy is really scaling with the size of the system. So by this way, this MERA answers, MERA, that solves the problem of entanglement entropy. But we might be also interested in QFT. And MERA is applicable for discrete quantum system, but if we want to go to the concrete continuous quantum system, we need something else. And that is called continuous MERA or CMERA. So the idea is also the same. In the previous slide, I have shown that the states are layered. So we are taking two sides, then we are adding them together, doing something disentangling and scaling. Then we are going to the next stage. But here the level is continuous. So we are starting from the U equals zero. U is the level parameter. So how we are doing this coarse graining and scaling, and U equals zero is the ultraviolet level, and U equals minus infinity is the IR level. And we have states, psi, that is for the UV level, and omega for the IR level. And this is the momentum cutoff. And this momentum cutoff is also scaling because as we are going deeper and deeper to the space, we are just shrinking we are just increasing the lattice spacing. That's why we're decreasing the momentum cutoff. So this is reflected in this line. So for a level U, the momentum cutoff is lambda e to the power U, and I want to mention that U is negative, so this is really decreasing. And this is the lattice constant. So what we are doing, that we are taking two sides, then we are adding them together here and here. So we're just increasing the size. Sorry, I have drawn it wrong. So we have taken this, then there is here. So now lattice constant is increasing. So that's why this is the line. So this is the epsilon lattice constant in the UV level. And this is the epsilon that is the lattice constant of a generic level. And you can see that U is negative. It is going from zero to negative. So that is always increasing. So this is the main idea of CMERA. And this is, as you can suspect, this is kind of renormalization. So here I tried to illustrate this. So this is the epsilon, that is the lattice constant for the UV level. And this is the lattice constant for some generic level. Now we are applying this disentangler. So what is it is doing? It is disentangling in this region. So there is no entanglement in this region. But now we are going to do the scaling, and after doing this scaling operation, this radius is increasing. So we are always doing with the same Hilbert space. Now this thing is quite abstract. Now I am going to show the formalism. So at the UV level, we are interested in the ground state, and that is denoted by state psi, and at the IR level, that is denoted by omega. And these two states are related by unitary transformation. Or if we just take a generic state at the level S, that is given by this unitary transformation. And the expression for this unitary transformation is written here. So as I have mentioned before, we are doing two operations. One is disentangler, so this is denoted by K of U. Another is the scaling operator. So, and this total thing is the unitary operator. And if we apply it, then you can get the state in some level S. Moreover, we can find the Heisenberg operator, just like we do in quantum mechanics. But in this sense, S is like acting as the time parameter. And if we just take the small variation of S, we can get this relation. So you can find this is almost like the Heisenberg equation. But for this case, time is replaced by the renormalization scale S. And This is the D plus one dimensional Klein Gordon field. And I have found in the literature that this is the scaling operator. And what it does, to see what it does, we have to find the Heisenberg equation of motion. And that will give us one differential equation. And the solution of this differential equation is this. So by this equation, we can see that this is really doing the scaling, because at level s and at the point x, the field value is e to the power s times x. So this is kind of scaling. And this prefactor, this is required for the wave functional renormalization, that what we have seen in our course of statistical mechanics. And the same goes for the momentum operator pi. So it is almost the same, but there is a difference in the dimension. And this is the expression for the disentangler that I have got in the literature. This meaning is not quite clear to me, so why this is explicitly the case. But maybe one interpretation might be, we're interested in the ground state, and the ground state does not carry any momentum. So the total momentum is zero here, and the total momentum is zero here too. But you can say that, okay, there might be some other possibilities, like phi of ks, phi of minus ks. I don't know why there is no term like this. So that is my next task to check these cases. By the way, if we assume, okay, this is the disentangler, then we can again find the Heisenberg equation of motion. By solving that Heisenberg equation of motion, we again find these two expressions. So the thing I want to mention is that before we have also found a prefactor, exponential prefactor, now we are also finding the exponential prefactor. So now, individually, we are getting the exponential prefactor. So if we add them together, there will be also some prefactor. So this is the answers that, okay, if we do those things together, the equation, the form of the field will be in this form. G is just the momentum cutoff, so that is non-zero when the momentum is less than or equal lambda, and that is zero when. Kind of a step function, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so it is stated like this. So step function is this, right? So this is lambda, but this may not be equal to one, so it can be something else, but outside this region, that is zero. It is kind of a step function, but not entirely. Yeah?
So in the previous case, the dimension of the fine pi is different by one than the previous case. Like the prefactor,
yeah.
It's the dimension is different by one, which makes sense. Pi is, yeah, that is totally.
Yeah, if we do the dimensional analysis, then we'll see that, okay.
Yeah, exactly. But in the next slide, yeah.
Okay, then I have not included one step, so it is quite complicated. So it says that, this scaling is not relativistically invariant. I don't know exactly how. So then they take one step further. I cannot recall exactly. Then by doing that, in the paper, they found, okay, so now this is becoming exactly equal. So, but I cannot recall exactly what was the step. But the reason is that there is some problem with relativistic invariance. That is just we're assuming some function. Because as I have argued, okay, if we apply this only, we are getting some function, exponential factor. If we are acting scaling, we are also getting some exponentials. So now I'm claiming, okay, if we operate them together, I will also get some exponential. And so this is the factor, and I am going to compute what is the expression for this f. Okay, now we are going to find the expression for f. So what we have to do, you have to again plug it into the Heisenberg-like equation of motion. These are the two equations of motions. And if we solve this, then we get this integral equation. Now we can also, in the paper it is claimed, okay, we can now write this in this form. And this is now the step function. And this is some unknown function that we don't know. Gamma is the step function. Gamma is not. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But in that case, we were in the UV level. Probably I missed. It should be also dependent on S. I missed it. Okay. Well, now we are going to find the expression for chi. And how do we find it? As I have said before, we're interested in the ground state energy, so we can find this expectation value of energy. Then we have to do the variation with respect to chi, and this minimization will give us the value of chi for this case. And it is claimed that by finding this chi of S, we are done. That means we know the ground state of this Hamiltonian for this case. Okay, now I'm moving to the part of holography. And I will next show what is the relationship between CMER and the holography. So we know that holography, this is also known as ADS CFT, and it says that certain gauge theory is dual to certain gravity theory. And this is explicit realization of Aethoop's idea of hologram. And in his paper of dimensional reduction in quantum gravity, he's saying that if we go close to the Planck scale, then the description of the space-time is not 3+1 dimensional, but 2+1 dimensional. And this two-dimensional space is acting as the hologram of the three-dimensional space. Then this idea was elaborated by Susskind, and he claimed that we can view this world as the hologram. And this gravity, in ADS CFT, the gravity theory that lies in a one dimensional higher than the gauge theory, and this is depicted here. So on the boundary, there is CFT, and in the bulk, there is ADS. So what is the relationship between this entanglement and holography? So now, as Pratik already mentioned, that how can we compute the entanglement entropy in a CFT? This is done by, very hard to pronounce, Ryu Takayanagi formula. And it says that, okay, this is our CFT, and we want to compute this entanglement entropy for this region B. And this thing is complicated if we want to do in CFT, but we can do the same thing in the ADS side. So what we have to do, we have to find a surface. And you can argue there might be infinite number of surfaces that has the boundary B. But we have to find the surface that has the minimum surface area. And this is the surface that is the minimum surface area. And we have to plug it in here. And that will give us the entanglement entropy for the region B. So now what is the idea? We are going to read the backward. So in MERA, what we are doing, we know the entanglement entropy for this case. And now we are trying to go to the bulk, and we are trying to find what might be the metric for this case. And in the literature, it is claimed, okay, the GTT component, or better, GSS component, this can be obtained by knowing the entanglement entropy for this region A. But the other components, it cannot be obtained unambiguously. So that is the task. It is remained for me to be done for my essay. And another part is that, okay, I have shown that this CMERA, that might be a candidate for QFT. And I have shown, okay, how this can be realized for the Klein-Gordon field. But the next task remained for me, is to find the relationship between the traditional QFT. For example, I am going to compute the correlation function and try to see what is the relationship between this correlation function and the Feynman propagator that we know from our course QFT, QFT 1 and 2. So probably I can answer some of these questions when I will come here again for my thesis defense. Okay. Yeah, that is my conclusion. So I thank you for listening.
I was confused at the point that why do you want to relate entanglement entropy? But like you said that's for MPS and like tree tensor network, the entanglement entropy scales like logarithm of the thing. So that's the problem. But why is that problem?
You're referring here? Okay, so look, this J is the variational parameter, so you can tune it. So that is at your hand. So you know your computational resource, then you can do whatever you like. But this is entirely not scaling with the size of the system, right? There is no indication that is dependent on the size of the system, but yeah, just a number. Yeah.
Of how many matrices you're putting, the dimension or the third rank of your matrix, of your tensor.
The
same thing there.
Third rank.
That the arm that's being cut corresponds to the rank of the tensor, one of the ranks, one of the indices of the tensors,
and
the dimension of that tensor, of that index, is J.
Yeah, alpha and beta, so it can run from 1 to J. So that is the J. So it clearly does not depend on the size of the system. So that's why that was the problem.
Because I don't understand why entanglement entropy in this case will tell you anything. So like what does it tell you?
So
for example, it doesn't.
Yeah, it tells that okay, this is not compatible with the entanglement entropy property, right? Because here I am saying, okay, this entanglement entropy is scaling with the size of the subsystem. But if we believe the matrix product is dead, but that is not the case. So if we are concerned with entanglement entropy, then we cannot use matrix product state, but we have to go for MERA. Because in MERA network, the entanglement entropy is depending on is proportional to the size of the system. So this is the reason. Entanglement, I think, yeah.
But actually, I don't understand why.
Yeah, it can represent, it can have some entanglement, but you see that the entanglement entropy is not following the property. So.
But what's the purpose of introducing this tensor network structure? Is it just to study the entanglement entropy?
No, I think, I'm not sure why this was introduced. Maybe to find a ground state Hamiltonian.
Which one?
Matrix product state.
Yeah, ground states of frustrated systems.
But why the incompatibility of the entanglement entropy will.
Sorry?
Why the entanglement entropy like doesn't match? Well,
MPS is very efficient compared to the other two there.
Yeah, because he's not concerned with entanglement entropy. He's only concerned about the ground state. But I am concerned about the entanglement entropy, so I'm not using matrix product state. He might use.
So basically you want to use this as a network structure to calculate entanglement?
MERA, not the... I want to use MERA.
Yeah.
Yep. That is true.
So your interest is on
that. Yep.
Yeah. Okay, let's stop here, stop our discussion, and thank Jewel again.
Okay, so first of all, thank you for being here. Today I'm going to talk about entanglement entropy, the triple of the Joule's fan because it's in three-dimensional space, but area law. Let me just do a remark. I will follow precisely this paper was one of the first to do this type of calculations. Actually, it was the second, but... So, let me give just a brief outline of the talk. First of all, I will do a small introduction. I already know that we were exposed to the subject, so we'll be very brief, and was just to refresh your mind a little bit. So after that, we will actually calculate what is needed to prove the area law in the QFT framework. And this is composed mainly three steps. The first step, the two coupled harmonic oscillators. The second step is the n-coupled harmonic oscillators. And the last step is QFT itself. And at the end, I will show you the result. It's only one result, but it's enough. And then the conclusions. Okay, so let us start. Entanglement entropy. What is special about entanglement entropy? Well, it mainly differs from the classical entropy, because the classical entropy, as we all know, depends on the scales with the volume of the system, while the entanglement entropy does not have this property. It scales, well, we already should suspect because of my title, but it scales with the area. So, because we already knew this from the start, we have this suspicion that it should scale with the area, and I will give you the logical argument that led us to suspect that. So let us consider, let me just do a draw because I will need in the future, near future. Like, okay, just consider the normal framework. Or better, the normal setup. We have a system. We create a division, and we are interested in two situations. The one, we trace out these degrees of freedom in our system, and we get rho in. And the other one, where we trace out these degrees of freedom, and we get rho out. So if we do that, as is mentioned here, if we do that and we calculate the entanglement entropy by the von Neumann definition right here, and because our density matrix can always be diagonalized, we can write in this form. And if we do that, we can prove that actually this true density matrix, the one with the inside degrees of freedom and the one with the outside degrees of freedom, have always the same eigenvalues, maybe differing only in the number of zeros. I think everybody's familiar with this concept, right? So I can, otherwise you can ask me later at the end. So it's obvious that since they have the same eigenvalues, well, they will have the same entanglement entropy. So this result led us to think that the entanglement entropy should depend only on the properties shared by the two regions. Because at any point, we mentioned how the regions were. Furthermore, because the entanglement entropy, or should I say, only the entropy is an extensive quantity, it should depend with the size, some size of the system or of the boundary. So we suspect that should be proportional to the area. But let me just add one more detail to discussion, because it will be also important for the rest of the talk. We are just saying that the entanglement entropy should scale with the area of the boundary shared by the two regions. But we know that the entanglement entropy, or the entropy generally speaking, is dimensionless. So we have to add some parameters, dimensionful parameters, to cancel this dependence. And naively, we have two at hand. So we have the infrared cutoff and the ultraviolet cutoff. So thinking a little bit further, we can exclude one of those, because imagine in this system, if I trace out the outside degrees of freedom, I don't know anymore what is going on here. This can be expanding, this can be contracting, I don't know. So the raw in doesn't know the size of the system, and we can kind of exclude this right away. So we are led with the, we are left with the ultraviolet cutoff, and we assume that, well, we suspect that we should get a formula of this kind, where kappa is just a parameter that reflects your choice for the ultraviolet cutoff. So this is about the area law. The goal of this talk is, at the end, to prove that we have an area law for a free, scalar, and massless quantum field theory with a unique ground state. To do so, I will give you just the prescription that we have to follow in each of those cases that I point out at the beginning, the two-couple and couple and QFT. I will give you the prescription so you know what we are doing. It's not difficult, but let me just say. So first of all, we need to calculate the fundamental state, then the density matrix, then we trace out degrees of freedom we don't care about, and then we calculate the eigenvalues of this new reduced density matrix, and then we can calculate the entanglement entropy. So let us first go for our simplest model that display entanglement. This is the two-couple harmonic oscillators. Hamiltonian as usual, we are considering massless because at the end we also are interested in massless theory. So there's no mass here. We have two constants for each of the harmonic plus a different constant for the coupling, the interaction term. As you already know, probably, this system is, to find the ground state of this system is very, very easy. It's a trivial calculation because you just have to find out the unitary transformation that basically decouples the harmonic oscillators. And if you rewrite the Hamiltonian in terms of these new variables that I introduced, x plus and x minus, you just see that you effectively decouple the two-couple harmonic oscillators into free harmonic oscillators with the new constants. So we already know how the ground state of the free harmonic oscillator looks like. Since we have two, is the direct product, and the angular frequencies are of this kind. So then, as I told you before, now that we know the ground state, we calculate the density matrix, we trace out one of the degrees of freedom. We only have two, so we will trace out the first harmonic oscillator. I will not do the calculations because they are trivial, and I'm sure you already gone through that. So we'll just state the result. And then, if you remember, the next step in our procedure was to calculate the eigenvalues of this reduced density matrix. This time I will also skip the calculation, not because this time not because it's trivial, but in the opposite end it's complicated. But I'm sorry. But there's a physical insight that kind of leads towards this result. That if you look at this is just the eigenfunctions are just of the form of harmonic oscillators. So it would be like if you get one of these equations and you don't know kind of how to solve, you just put harmonic oscillators and kind of, you suspect from here, right? So it's not that complicated. So at the end of the day, what we want is the eigenvalues of this reduced density matrix, and they are of this form. Maybe I should write on the board because I'm not sure if I put in the next slide. Okay. So maybe we need this. No, I put. Okay. So now we have the eigenvalues. We just have to calculate the entanglement entropy and summing, doing the series, we get this result. It's not difficult. I would just like to point out that, as we expected, the result depends only on the ratio of K1 and K0 that were the couple the constants that we had in the first Hamiltonian. Okay, so next step is to calculate then a couple harmonic oscillators. This is not much difficult than the previous case, because you just have to realize that because we are this K matrix represents an interaction, must be symmetric, so it can always be diagonalized. And doing so and defining this new matrix is just defined as being the square of the interaction matrix. So But if you define this matrix, you find out that your ground state is just the direct product of the decoupled harmonic oscillators, again, and decoupled harmonic oscillators. And then, again, we trace out the degrees of freedom we don't want. In this case, are the first and harmonic oscillators. Exactly, so ones here. And to do this previous integral, you just have to realize that because, again, the K matrix is symmetric, you can always write your angular frequencies matrix like this, and the calculations reduce to Gaussian integrals. So then you do the calculations. I will put just proportional because we always know the renormalization. We can always renormalize our density matrix, so I won't be bothered by constants and stuff like that. So here, let me just point out, because it's important, I mentioned here. So because this new matrix, this beta and gamma, don't commute, now we don't have anymore a thermal density matrix. We had previously because were only two and they were numbers here, so we always had that. But this is just a side note, because at the end of the day, it will solve itself, you will see. So, but we should be careful when we do these calculations, because this can represent a little bit of trouble. Not in this case, but it could. So now that we have the reduced density matrix, I already told you the procedure at least two times. So after we have this, we just have to calculate eigenvalues. Again, we have the integral, an integral equation to solve, and we will solve by noticing that this, the determinant G of this matrix, has the exact same eigenvalues than this density matrix. So we can just what this tells us is just that we can basically change variables at our freedom, because this is pretty general. So we will do two variables transformations, and doing this and then this, again, I will skip the algebra. We will get the reduced density matrix, and now because these are the eigenvalues of this matrix, we actually get a thermal density matrix. So the problem that I told you is solved and was automatic. So what is important about this formula? What is important about this formula is that the fact that if you remember that was the formula I want to keep and I forgot. So if you remember, for the two couple harmonic oscillators, we get here. We get this formula is exactly the same as we obtain in this step. So it's a product of the same type of reduced density matrix that we had when we were dealing with the two couple harmonic oscillators. So we already know how to solve this because we did previously. And because this is a product, the entropy will be just the sum of each of these new pairs of two couple harmonic oscillators. So we already know how to calculate the entanglement entropy, and this is the formula. is exactly the same as we did before, but now with this definition. Okay, so we finally got to the QFT framework, and here again, we will consider it a massless scalar free field, quantum field. And to actually do the calculations, we will introduce the partial wave components, like here, like is stated here. And yeah, yeah, three plus one. So introducing these new fields with this new this commutation relation, that is the what we should expect. Rewriting the Hamiltonian in terms of these new fields, we basically reduce our problem to one-dimensional problem. Okay. So far we did no approximations, but as Pratik told in his presentation two weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, no matter what you do, to calculate the entanglement entropy, you always have to put a cutoff in your theory. Otherwise, you get divergence. It doesn't a way to escape that part. So we will do the easiest way, or Shredniki did the easiest way, that is to put our theory in a lattice. So basically, our theory is now in a lattice with spacing A. So this gives us the ultraviolet cutoff. And we will also use as infrared cutoff, basically a spherical box of size NA. So the infrared cutoff will be 1 over that. We also demand that our field, we also impose that our field is not outside that box, spherical box. And plugging all this in the previous equation and discretizing the integral, we get this Hamiltonian. So it's not difficult to see that this Hamiltonian has exactly the same structure of the n-couple harmonic oscillators. And we already know how to solve that. So basically, at each L and M, we have an n-couple harmonic oscillator system, and we have to solve. At the end, the Hamiltonian is the is the sum of these. Our ground state function is the product of each of these ground state functions, and the entropy should be the sum. Moreover, because you can see in hypothetically, this could depend on L on M, but it actually doesn't happen. It only depends on L. So we can just neglect the M and say that we have two L plus one M's, and that's how we will sum. So putting this to work, we get the result I was claiming. As you can see, we get a straight line and as the best fit, and the dots are actually pretty neat. Let me just mention something. Here, there's a mistake. It's an R squared, not an R. This coefficient is not universal. It depends on your discretization. We went to a lattice. We could go to another theory. As I told you before, you'll get a kappa here that it will depend on your choice. Yeah. So, okay, Harry Law proven. Okay, I think I should leave now. No, I'm joking. Like, let's just go through the conclusions. So we have proven the area law, not proven, sorry, shown the area law for free scalar and massless quantum field theory in its unique ground state. Let me just mention that this argument holds just as good as as for d equals 3 in the case d equals 2. It's obvious that it doesn't work in one dimension, because otherwise you have no scaling in one dimension, and you should expect this kind of behavior in one dimension. The typo here should obviously have an R here, because it has to scale, right? And for d equals or bigger than 4, the series, this series, like this series doesn't converge. So, well, I think I said everything I need.
Okay, let's thank you. We'll give the group some other time for questions. Any questions? So, could you, Peter, you
have a question? Oh, yeah.
Do you?
I was just going to ask quickly, like, what a thermal density is, as opposed to what you had
before. Okay, so basically, it's just like a density matrix that maximizes the entanglement entropy when it's restricted to the energy, when you restrict the energy of the system. So you should expect that, right?
So what does that have to do with the matrix is not
commuting? Oh, no, not commuting means that there's no, it's not a thermal density matrix, it's just that. But then it solves out. You do a change of coordinate and it's done. You don't need to worry about that. No, it's just, it should be, because it should maximize entanglement entropy, right? It's a ground state and it should maximize. Otherwise, it would be nonsense, the theory.
Okay. With the result, what did you create?
Oh, yeah. I didn't mention explicitly. So what we consider here is like, this is like the results are for a system with big N equals capital N equals 60. And so you basically trace out the initial 1, 2, until 30. And these are displaying the entanglement entropy of that. And you are plotting against R that is given by. So basically, you want to trace out, this is your, and you go to the in between the boundary of your. Yeah. It's completely imaginary. This result is very important because it gives you insights like black hole entropy. You have this area law that is very mystical. You use all these kind of arguments to derive it, and this just tells you, okay, it would be expect any kind of thing that you use, just neglect some part of the space, you will get an area law. So
if you take this n further than
31,
does it go down?
Yeah, it should, but you are doing numerics, it doesn't go down. Yeah. Until clash, it doesn't go down. The series doesn't. Yeah, but even after you do the cutoff, it depends on your your discretization choice, right? So, everything goes smooth until this part that you have to check out that this actually converge. It's just that. I don't see. Maybe I'm not understanding your question.
I would believe that.
Yeah, but you choose your cutoff poorly.
Yes, you're saying lattice discretization.
Yeah, it's like trying to put a lattice in curve back in curved space. So you know that you can try, but
so in high dimensions, can you take a different kind of
sure. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to prove. So hopefully, yes, I can show that. I don't know. For now, I don't know.
Okay, any other questions? So if you have no more questions, let's thank Nader again.
Thank you.